Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.
From Buffalo, Toronto Public Media, this is What's Next, an hour dedicated to amplifying the voices of marginalized and underrepresented communities across Western New York and Southern Ontario.
We cannot erase, we cannot reform, we cannot make things better if we're uncomfortable having tough conversations,
Absolutely.
If we're uncomfortable
Absolutely.
Talking about race.
What's Next carries forward our mission to engage in meaningful conversations about race, equity, and the shared concerns that deeply affect Buffalo's East Side and beyond.
Don't stop. Make those families part of your life. Their lives are part of yours. Don't stop.
Together, we dive into the real issues, striving for understanding, connection, and change.
In the suburban area, everywhere, we must work and teach our children.
Hello, and welcome to What's Next. I'm disability reporter Emily Watkins. Earlier this month, I embedded myself with a group of mental health advocates from Buffalo. They went to Albany and back in the same day to voice their support for voluntary, peer-led services in the state budget. Today on What's Next, I'll take you through some of the conversations I had that day. After a five-hour ride to Albany, our bus reached the Capitol Complex at 8 a.m. I wanted to talk with Mike Seitz, the bus captain, first, to hear his thoughts on the day ahead.
Okay, Mike, we just got to Albany. Tell me a little bit about how everyone's feeling, how you're feeling.
I think everybody's feeling a little tired, but optimistic, excited. I mean, this is what we do. We talk about access to opportunity when we're talking about mental health recovery, right? And that includes acclimating to life, at making sure that we know that we have voices and our voices can be heard, making sure we know that what we need matters. So, I'm psyched.
How was the ride? Did everyone sleep? Is everyone hydrated?
There was a lot of sleeping until there was a very definitive moment. There was a lot of sleeping until there wasn't. It was very quiet, and then I heard my name several times, and I said, I feel like a little kid. Okay, it's time to get up. Everybody get up.
Awesome.
The group then made their way through the underground, mall-like tunnels that connect all the government buildings. The day started with breakfast in the Egg, which is a performing arts venue in the complex. It's here that Rita Lorenz sat down with me to share why she came.
What brought you out here today?
I wanted to come check this out and see if it's something I want to continue to do, to try to help.
And what is it you're doing today? Like, how would you describe it?
You know, it's hard for me to describe. I'm very good at describing anything.
You're just kind of in for the ride?
Yeah, to see, and then if I like it, I'm going to try to come back out again next year.
What was it like waking up at 2, 3 in the morning?
I was up actually up all night.
Oh,
playing
cards, all night.
Drinking Red Bull and a pop.
Oh my gosh. You have a lot of energy for someone who didn't sleep.
I slept on the bus the whole way.
Oh, nice, nice. Oh my gosh.
Well, she'll tell you I always got a lot of energy.
Yeah. And I know today the goal is to talk about mental health support and resources and policy that can help people. What are you most looking forward to, like, learning about or sharing with legislators?
Probably about what I've gone through with my mental health, to hope that we can get more grants for more mental health places, to get more stuff going, you know, because we need it.
Yeah. What are some of the things you would say that Western New York needs?
They need a lot. Shelters for the homeless, more places for mental health to go to, because some people aren't ready to get the help they need, and we've only got maybe one or two drop-in centers in New York. In Buffalo, we need more for that.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, if you get a chance to talk with a legislator today, what would you want them to know about people living with mental health conditions?
I tell them it's very tough on us, especially when you're trying to get Social Security. It's hard they've been denying me for years since I was 16, and I'm still fighting to this day to get it. It's hard for us people with mental health because we just want to give up sometimes. And we need people that are going to support us and be there for us to keep us going and not give up on us.
I'm glad you didn't give up on yourself.
I'm proud of myself for that too.
Can I ask, was there something in your journey that really made a difference in your recovery or where you're at now?
I think it would have to be my mom and my fiance. They've both been very supportive. My mom passed away in 19. It's been rough without her. And then when I got back with my fiance, we've been together almost 3 years now. He's been so supportive, including with my mom being gone.
I'm sorry for your loss. At that point, I shut off my recorder and we agreed we'd talk more later. The group then made their way to the Capitol building for a press conference. Luke Sakinney, the public policy director for the Alliance for Rights and Recovery, shared more about the planning behind the day. So tell me how your morning's going so far.
Morning's good. The thing about this event for us is everybody else is up at, 2, 1 a.m., 3 a.m., 4 a.m., so for me, I get to get up to make sure everyone's on the buses, so I'm kind of up with them at the same time. But it's always good to hear how people are so excited to get up here. I think the fact that folks from Buffalo are up at 1 a.m. trying to get on a bus by 3 just tells you how important it is to everyone about this and how exciting the day can be.
Were you in Albany this morning?
Yes, I was in Albany, got up bright and early. Luckily, I didn't have to travel as much as all these other folks, but tried to keep it as exciting for folks as when they get here. We want to make sure that we can greet them, they see that welcoming face, and know exactly what's going on as we start the day.
And can you talk about what we're walking to right now?
Yeah, so we're going to be walking to a press conference on involuntary treatment. We're pushing as the Alliance and our fellow advocates for alternatives to involuntary treatment, including peer-based services, recovery services in general, as well as more person-centered, community-based care that doesn't utilize coercion or involuntary treatment methods. So we have a number of those that we need to call for. And as we see the legislature begin to question the initiatives that the governor has put forth, we really want to make sure that we get our voice out there, that we are represented well, and this press conference is one way to do so. We'll be having our legislative champions, including Senator Samuel Brook, Assemblymember Chandler Waterman, as well as Assembly Mental Health Committee Chair Joanne Simon, speaking with us, along with a number of effective advocates and mental health providers and folks who utilize mental health services. So we're really excited for this as one way that we get our word out and try to get folks to, take some press of the event and then follow that up with the actual meetings of the day.
And why is it so important to have people living with mental health conditions at the forefront of today, going to legislators, being in front of the press?
I think, historically speaking, folks with mental health challenges don't have the opportunity to speak out and be heard about these kinds of issues. So often decisions are being made about them without any input. So one of the things that the Alliance has consistently done since our creation has been to try to get opportunities to have that voice be heard and to make sure that those folks are able to specifically state this directly to legislators, to news outlets, to everyone here in Albany, because they often don't get that opportunity.
Thank you. As advocates stood in the long line to go through security for the Capitol building, Quajo, another member of the Buffalo group, explained the day was also an important time for advocates to share resources. And why did you decide to join this trip today?
I joined this trip last year. I felt that it was very informative. It was a lot of people that came together, a lot of agencies that came out, showed and support one another. I just thought to come back a second time to see what type of information I can grab and what type of people I can communicate and network with and see where it goes from there.
And why Why were you motivated to wake up at 2 in the morning to go on this trip to talk about mental health? Like, why is that an issue that matters to you?
I have a couple of mental healths, but it's always good to see another person, you know, going through it, so that way we can uplift each other. And, you know, I feel like coming to this big gathering, it's all different types of stories that you'll hear, you know, all different backgrounds. But at the end of the day is how we made it to the other end, or how we got past our, you know, our little bump in the road, or as you would say. But other than that, like I said, coming here, just learning that, you know, it's so many resources here that I didn't even know back home, or couldn't find out at my local, you know, RAF building, or, you know, place where I get my food stamps or stuff like that. But it's real happy. Like, I can't tell you how much happy I am just to see people here, you know, acknowledging and trying to work towards a solution. And I think that's pretty dope.
And you're waiting in line to join a press conference in the Capitol. What is that like? What are you feeling in this moment? Are you excited to get in front of the news and talk about this issue?
No, not really. I'm just here to see what's on everybody's mind and the point of view. I mean, like, just like I have my point of views. Even watching the news, just to see where, like, we are going as a society. I feel like as I come here, I can kind of see, like, you know, I hate to say, do we still have, like, sympathy for one another, or even, like, for the people that's homeless out on the streets, that they suffer from mental illness or whatever that they go through? What are we doing to help these type of people? I do hear that it will be programs cut in the government budget and stuff like that. I hope not, but, you know, everybody wish for the best. So.
Absolutely. And are there any certain programs that you're really interested in learning about or advocating for today?
Mental health awareness, of course. Also looking forward to see if the nurses show up. I also want to talk to them about, you know, a few classes that I want to take myself. And other than that, just go around and see who's actually here.
Are you interested in going into nursing?
Yes. I want to take my LPN classes. After my LPN, I want to get into radiologist and see if those two, if I didn't like those two, then that's all I really want out of, you know, nursing. So.
Are you hoping to work in the mental health field?
Later on, yes. Yes, I am.
While on the federal level, cuts have been the main discussion, in New York, the debate is more focused on how to distribute the money where it's going to be the most helpful. At the press conference, a major focus was asking the governor not to increase funding to involuntary treatment, but instead allocate that funding to voluntary and peer-led services. Currently, Governor Kathy Hochul and the legislature seem at odds over expanding involuntary commitment. While Hochul proposed expansion, the legislature has omitted that from their proposed budget. And another aspect of involuntary treatment Hochul has sought to expand is Kendra's Law, which is also called Assisted Outpatient Treatment, or AOT. It's essentially court-ordered mental health treatment. Kendra's Law isn't permanent and will be up for review in 2027. It's another major concern for advocates, including Carla Rabinowitz, who spoke during the press conference about her experience with both AOT and peer-led services. Carla started reading her story, which you'll hear, and then another advocate read her story again for clarity.
I want to tell my story. I'm Carla Rabinowitz. I want to tell my story about AOT. 97.
Can I read this for you?
Yes.
Okay. So, thank you, Carla. I'm going to read for her really quickly. Carla, do you want to stay here with me for a moment?
Yeah.
Love you, Carla. Yeah. So, I'm Carla Rabinowitz. I want to tell my story about AOT. From 1996 to 2001, I got progressively sicker. I went in and out of hospitals and was all but lost to myself. I was screaming on the street. I was walking the city streets at 3 a.m., very unlike me. I describe this time as my werewolf form, London time. I was unrecognizable to myself. At one time, I was screaming so hard and so often, I bought a boxer's mouthpiece to stop myself from screaming. It didn't work. I just spit out the mouthpiece and continued screaming. I lost my law license due to my severe mental illness. I went in front of a judge and they said AOT. I was in AOT for a year. I was in hospitals many times. It sucked. I did not like it. AOT separated me from life outside. Community Access hired me and saved my life. I started working at Community Access as part of the peer program, counseling people experiencing mental health issues after 9/11. Community Access is a place of healing. In my 20 years working at Community Access, peers helped me a lot. I got support from peers and they helped me find a home, live independently in a co-op, accumulate some money and save for retirement and find myself again. I felt motivated to see a psychiatrist and I was finally rewarded my law license back after lots of hard work.
The same day these advocates were in Albany, Politico posted a new story about assisted outpatient treatment. It cited two reports, including one published by the New York Lawyers for the Public Interest, about how people of color have disproportionately been impacted by Kendra's law. To quote part of that report, NYLPI states, "The state's own data indicate that 38% of current involuntary outpatient commitment orders involve Black individuals, despite the fact that Black individuals only make up 17.7% of the population. 26% of the orders involve Hispanic individuals, who only make up 19.8% of the population, while 31% of the orders involve white people, although white individuals make up 54% of the population. These disparities have existed for at least the past 20 years," end quote. The report also cites studies which question the efficacy of involuntary treatment compared to voluntary treatment. I caught up with Ruth Lowenkron, one of the co-authors of the report and NYLPI's director of the Disability Justice Program. She's invested in ending involuntary treatment. And tell me a little bit about the group you're here representing.
Sure. I'm with the Disability Justice Program at New York Lawyers for the Public Interest. That's my employer. And we are an advocacy organization, Public Interest Law Office. We have three major areas of concentration, and one of them is in disability justice, and I'm the director of that program.
Are you an attorney yourself?
I am.
And how did you get into disability justice work?
Well, I'd like to say a few parts serendipity and a few parts it made a whole lot of sense to me. So when I was graduating college and looking for an appropriate nonprofit to work in, I went to one called Untapped Resources, and I like to say I had no idea what it was, but they were interested in me, so I ran there, and it turned out it was disability, and I've been doing it ever since. But a little closer to the truth is the fact that my father had a physical disability and my sister had a mental disability, she's still alive, thank goodness, mental disability. And so I was really very close to disability issues and I was really a disability advocate from a very young age. And so it all clicked. And I also like to say that I have other passions in my life, and there were many times when I was thinking about switching jobs, should I get into another area? And I would always say, well, no, not this time. The Americans with Disabilities Act just went into effect, couldn't change now. And then ultimately, I've been doing this work for 40 years, so it is my passion.
That's incredible. And I also grew up with a family members with disabilities, so I understand where you're coming from. Can you tell me a little bit about why specifically you spoke out on involuntary commitment, voluntary services, peer-led services today? Why are those so important?
Sure. Again, a piece of it comes from my own background. When my sister was voluntarily committed into a hospital in Connecticut, and I went there to visit her, that really, I mean, I'd already been very active in the space, but seeing it firsthand, that really pushed me to be the loud voice that I am. The real deprivation of rights in that context. And again, she was there voluntarily. But to think that somebody would end up in circumstances where they have lost all of their independence, their rights to choose what kind of medication, to choose when to go to bed, to choose what to eat, any of those things taken away, something very wrong with that. And of course, over the years, I've done a lot of reading in the space, and it just simply is not the answer. We want to ensure that people choose the areas of treatment that they avail themselves of, choose the kind of social services that they need. We have to offer it as a society, but then we have to make it available by choice. And the idea that we would force somebody into a space which so often is so degrading, it's wrong-headed. And what we know is that people who are committed over objection are more likely to be treatment resistant. Stands to reason, right? If someone tells you, you must do this, and you end up having to do it over objection, chances are quite good that you're not going to like what was happening to you and not want to repeat that again. And so you're going to stay undercover and not really allow yourself to get whatever minimal services are available in a commitment kind of a circumstance. So it's from my, I guess, my experiences, but also from reading what the professionals have to say.
I know that's something I've heard over and over again from people who are pushing for Kendra's Law, who are pushing for involuntary commitment. They claim that people with serious mental illness are not able to make those decisions for themselves. How would you respond to that? I know today you're going to legislative visits. If a legislator says that to you, what's the response?
I think the response is that, first of all, that's not true. The vast majority of people with mental disabilities have issues that they need assistance with, but they haven't lost their minds. They haven't lost their ability to make choices, and they shouldn't be deprived of that ability. Now, there are people who are doing things. I mean, we heard this morning, you weren't there, but at the press conference.
Oh,
you were at the press conference too. Okay. So you've heard the story of one of our amazing advocates, Carla Rabinowitz, talking about how she didn't even recognize herself. She was doing this. So we know that that can happen to people with disabilities, but what do they need? That's the question. So now you know we have people like that, then what do they need? And what they need is the voluntary service. And it's very interesting. I learned a lot from Harvey Rosenthal. And one of the things he teaches me is, yes, it's absolutely voluntary, but it is high engagement, high pushing to say, don't you want our services? And if they're not going to accept them the first time, you don't take no for an answer. You don't coerce someone, but you offer again, and you offer again. And if the approach of saying, what's your favorite ice cream? Mine is vanilla doesn't work, then the next day you say, oh my God, I see you're wearing a Mets t-shirt, my favorite. You find the ways to connect, and you try, and you try, and you try. And I think what we've heard today about the INSET program, for example, amazing statistics. It's an entirely voluntary program, but they go out and meet the people where they are. And again, if they're not going to come with them on day one, they're not going to accept their offer of clean socks, whatever it is, and they'll go back and they'll go back again. And those are the means that work, and the government knows that. New York State knows that. How do we know that? Because they are funding the INSET program. They're funding the peer breachers. That's where they need to concentrate their efforts and energies, in those services that have amazing track records.
For people who aren't familiar, can you just briefly explain what INSET is and what it stands for?
Sure, and others can do this much better, as you asked me before. I'm just a lawyer, and I know what I know, as I say, from talking with others. But INSET is a program that really very much is like what I said. It's a program of individuals who meet people with mental health where they're at and try to bring whatever services it is that they need. And also don't have that mindset, oh, what everyone needs is treatment. Certainly don't have the mindset, what everyone needs is drugs or medication, excuse me. But what they ensure is, what would this person need? Maybe it's those clean socks I mentioned before. Maybe it's employment skills training. They don't have housing. That's a no-brainer. Then let's do something for them to get them housing. So that is what the INSEAD program is about. Meeting people where they are, literally, in terms of finding people, and then meeting them where they are in their lives at that moment, and figuring out what kind of needs they have.
Reiterated throughout the day was the fact peers aren't just people with lived experience with mental health conditions. Many peers have also undergone extensive training to be certified by the state as a peer specialist. Advocates argue they may not only keep people out of the hospital, but prevent people from dying or being incarcerated while in crisis. After the press conference, when advocates returned to the Egg to hear from experts, Assemblymember Eddie Gibbs shared his perspective as someone who was formerly incarcerated.
Good afternoon. Now, I know it's a cold Albany afternoon and it's a Tuesday, but we could do better than that. Alliance, let's make some noise. Good afternoon. Yeah, I need that energy, you know, I need that energy. I'm here, you know, first and foremost, my name is Eddie Gibbs. I'm New York State Assembly member representing the 68th Assembly District in East Harlem. Excuse my Pittsburgh still a hat. Yeah, East Harlem, yeah. I made history 4 years ago by becoming the first formerly incarcerated New York State legislature. Yeah, it's a big thing. It's a big thing here. And, you know, over the years, we've been pushing some serious legislation and partnering with Alliance. And I am so excited about your priorities. Alternative to involuntary treatment, expanding voluntary mental health services, investing in housing first models, 7.8% rate enhancement, and Daniel's Law. I want to talk a little bit about Daniel's Law, if that's okay. I mean, as the first formerly incarcerated individual, I've seen a lot of things inside prison, amen? And I want to say that it's time for the long-awaited Daniel's Law to pass so we can stop criminalizing mental illness. We need treatment, not jails, because too many people, especially people of color, get caught up in the criminal system, the criminal justice system, due to their mental health challenges. How many of us know people who are locked up right now due to mental health challenges? How many of us have friends and family members who are locked up right now because of mental health challenges? We need systems that serve people, not use the criminal system just as a mental health system. A lot of my friends, they need hospitals. They need services. They need these doctors to come in and diagnose them. But the judges say, hey, let's imprison them. It's not right. Let's send them to prison and let them figure out what's wrong with these men and women. And these men and women suffer daily in prison.
Daniel's Law, which the legislature has included funding for in their proposed budget, would provide trained crisis response teams of EMTs, peers, and mental health professionals to respond to a crisis rather than police. The law is named after Daniel Prude, a 41-year-old Rochester man who was killed when restrained by police during a mental health crisis in 2020. Christina Sparrick, who serves on the state's task force for Daniel's Law, shared why it's personal for her.
Oh, definitely. I'm passionate about Daniel's Law. I'm a person who has lived experience of living with bipolar, and I had police come to my house one day, and it was during COVID, and someone was banging on my door, and I didn't know who it was, and I lived in a doorman building. And so immediately, since I didn't know who was at my door, I ran into the kitchen and grabbed a knife only to defend myself. Because I felt, you know, somehow my rights were being violated. And I just kept him banging and banging and banging on my door, and I freaked out. When the banging stopped, I called the doorman. They said the police were there to do a wellness check. If my door were unlocked that day, they would have came in, and I could have gotten shot. And their body cam footage would have shown that I was some kind of deranged woman, you know, yielding a knife and racing at them. And in fact, I was a woman who was scared in her house with a knife, regardless of my diagnosis. Because anybody else, if someone's banging on your door and they're gonna come in, you would do anything you could to defend yourself. It's a frying pan, it's a chair, or whatever you're gonna pick up, you will defend yourself. So I would have been killed that day. So I'm advocating for, like, if there's a wellness check for peers, people with lived experience who are crisis-trained peers who have compassionate care to respond to people who are in crisis. Because police, they're trained in the use of force and to respond to crime. When you look at, when you call 911, 911 has, should have three responses, right? If you call for a fire, get FDNY. If you call for a medical issue, you get the ambulance. If you call for crime, you get the police. But if you call for crime and, or mental health, you still get the police. And that's why the police are trained to use force against people with mental health conditions, which is not fair. We need a public health response, which is like Daniel's Law. When you have crisis-trained peers and an EMT worker to come out to your home when you're in crisis to give you the supports that you need, the emotional support and the medical support that you need, and then have them decide if you need to go to the hospital or you need other any other type of treatment, the police should not be involved at all.
I'm really sorry that happened to you. And something that struck me as you were talking about that is just how something as simple as how someone knocks can impact someone's emotions and response. And I guess I'm wondering, like, in terms of responding to people in mental health crisis, I'm trying to think of the right way to word this. Like,
how do you respond to them?
Yeah, like, do you feel like it's major changes that need to be made? Or is it just like those little things, like thinking about how you knock, thinking about how you talk to someone? Like, is that training something that's super complicated and expensive, or is it really not as difficult as people make it out to be?
So right currently now, police get CIT training. It's called crisis intervention training, where they are taught by clinicians and social workers and other officers on how to properly engage with people, peers who are living with mental health concerns. When I was part of the CIT program, there was only, I think, maybe 1 hour of a 36-hour training on just me presenting to, me and other peers presenting to the police. But that was a very small percentage of the training. It would be really good if peers alone were able to train the whole 36, 38 hours to the police, because they'll get to understand that we are human, we have feelings, we are capable, we're competent, and we're not dangerous, right? I find people who don't have diagnosis more dangerous to me, because those are the people who trigger me and get me sick. But who comes to them when they're committing, when they're triggering me, are they held responsible for their actions? No, I'm held responsible for my actions, but no one asks me what happened. They look at me as what's wrong with me. Ask me what happened and I'll tell you. And then we could have a conversation about how the other person triggered me or activated me. But also, not even that, why don't you check their behavior also, right? It takes two people. And so, as with the training with peers, we learn how to have compassion, because we've been through it. We know how to navigate the system. We know how to recovery looks like, because we have our ups and downs. So we're best suited to talk to somebody and say, hey, you know, I'm here with you. Teach me how to, let me know how I could best support you. Can I sit next to you? Do you mind if I ask you your name? If you want to vent, just keep venting. I'm here to support you. Yeah, we're here for an hour. You keep screaming. It's okay. Because you know what? I'm here to support you, and I want you to be okay. And then you tell me, is it a housing issue? Is it a domestic violence issue? Is it a criminal justice issue? It could be any issue that the person's dealing with at any particular time while they're in crisis. And that's our job as crisis-trained peers, to sit there with you through the moment and help you through that journey and the recovery process and help you get the care that you need. Because the problem is that the system is failing, and that's why people are in crisis. If we don't have culturally responsive, trauma-informed, person-centered care, how can you help people? You have the cookie-cutter box medication. You all must take more medication. And medication's not for everyone. You have alternative medicine that could be holistic care, like Reiki, chakra, meditation, yoga, Pilates. It could be a combination of things that can help people do their recovery. So it's like we need to start really more connecting with each other as human beings and get to know each other and what makes us tick. For me, my friends who are close to me know when I'm in crisis, I love vanilla bean ice cream and I love my Elmo. So if I'm in a corner, snot nose, whatever, give me my vanilla bean ice cream and my Elmo, and I'll be all right. But don't dismiss me. Ask me what I need when I'm not well, and I'll tell you. And if you're my friend or my accountability partner, if you choose me my accountability partner, then you do what I'm asking you to do, because then we can recover and help with my recovery.
Thank you so much for sharing that. And, you know, today is all about connecting with peers from across the state, hearing about issues from Buffalo to Binghamton to the Adirondacks down in New York City where you are. What are some of the commonalities you're hearing about what people are facing?
Definitely the failures of systems. We do not have enough mental health resources in the community. I know, like, I was in a Daniels Law task force, and people in New York City think that New York City is the center of the world, which it probably is, right? But we don't. Sometimes we neglect that other communities may not have the funding that maybe New York City has to get the adequate resources. They may not have the community-based services to provide the supports that they need. They may not have, and they may be heavily reliant on the police only because that's all they have. See, New York City, we only have, like, I think approximately 24 mobile crisis teams, which is not good. We have a city of about 9 million people. And if you're asking a crisis mobile team that has a peer and a social worker to come out to your house, and they're supposed to be responding, like, maybe in 20 minutes, they can't because they're responding to everybody else in the five boroughs. And that's how the police get involved, because if you don't have an adequate support, adequately funded program to support you, police get involved. So it's more like what we need across the state is more funding and having our elected officials fund our programs, but especially the ones that have a good track record. Don't fund every program.
Funding these services also means paying for these workers, which became the focus of the last event of the day. After the experts in the egg and a quick lunch, advocates filled the war room in the Capitol building for a rally. They were pushing for a 7.8% cost of living increase for frontline mental health workers. Since then, the legislature has confirmed their support for this COLA in their One House budget.
Not institutions.
7.8.
We can't wait. 7.8. We can't wait. 7.8.
12 hours after the group had left for Albany, they were back on the bus and heading back to Buffalo. Rita took a moment to share with me how her day had gone. How are you feeling, like, physically, emotionally, after everything today?
Physically tired. And honestly, emotionally happy.
It's great. I feel like when we talked this morning, it was kind of, like, heavy in a way. Like, I think it was... seemed like you were, like, kind of feeling the emotions of, like, everything that was about to be talked about. Tell me how you went from that to feeling happy and positive by the end of the day.
Well, usually when something like that does happen, that's how I normally feel, because I've gone through it myself. And I want to see others get the help. And seeing that they are going to be getting the help is what makes me happy about that whole situation. Because I've gone through it, and it really sucks, and others don't know how to get through it. And I try to help them the best I can. But now that we're able to get more grants and stuff to get people the help that they need, it's really good. It makes me happy.
I asked how she got into mental health advocacy.
How did you get involved with mental health advocacy? I don't know if we talked about that this morning.
My mom, when Apartment Academy used to be a club, my mom was going there. I was 16. I used to go with her. And when me and my fiance went homeless, I told him there's got to be somewhere we can go to get the help. He suggested there, and ever since I've been going. And that's September of last year.
And how are you doing today? You said you were homeless a year ago.
Actually, we're doing good. We got an apartment coming up either sometime this month or April 1st.
That's so exciting. Congrats. How does it feel to, like, see that progress in your life?
It's wonderful, because it just shows me that if I can do it, I can help others get it done as well, which I try to do.
Absolutely. I feel like I met a lot of people today who were either previously unhoused or currently unhoused, and I think that people have, like, an image of someone who's unhoused in their head, and then actually meeting people, it's really different. Is there anything you wish people knew about the experience of being homeless, or, you know, just what it's actually like, or who you actually are? Like, how that... I don't think people realize it can happen to anyone, because I've met people from all different walks of life who have become unhoused or homeless.
I never thought it would happen to me, and it did. And I'm like, okay, what resources are out here that I can utilize? And no matter where you are, there's always some kind of resource. Like, in Buffalo, we got the nurses that come to the bus station on Tuesdays and Thursdays. We got Regina's on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Saturdays at 7 p.m. right diagonal in Farmers Park from the bus station. We got a food truck that comes Tuesday through Saturday, varying between like 5 and 6:30 through them days. And then you also have people that come hand out food and clothes during the weekend. On both Saturday and Sunday, you got people that come do church out on the street on Sundays. Whether you're homeless or not, you can go hand out free food. There's so many resources out there that people can use, and people just don't want to do it.
Do you think there's something in particular that makes people not want to access that, or that is a barrier?
I think it's a barrier because a lot of people, I know when I first went homeless, I was afraid to ask for any kind of help. And that was my barrier. I think that's the main barrier that's going around, is that nobody wants to ask for help.
Can I ask why you didn't want to ask for help?
Because I thought I could do it on my own. And boy, was I wrong. But I'm glad I started asking for help.
What kind of resources helped, like, lift you out of that and empower you to get to a place where you're moving into your own place again?
Empowerment Academy, definitely. They were the biggest support. Plus, the staff up there and the nurses at the bus station, they've all been very wonderful in supporting me in my journey to get to where I'm at.
Empowerment Academy, which Rita mentions, is part of Restoration Society, a Buffalo organization that had a strong representation on the bus. Mike, the bus captain, who works at Restoration Society as a certified peer, shared what that job is like and why it matters.
Talk a little bit about, you know, got a little less energy now than this morning.
I know, that's the reverse. The day was great. Every day in our morning meetings at the recovery center, we always talk about, you know, how different recovery can look for each person any given day. And we talk about, as folks get reacclimated into the quote-unquote real world from our community and from our recovery community, you know, take advantage of every opportunity that presents itself, you know. Put yourself out there, take a chance. You know, and we say at our center that if you come in and if you're waiting for somebody to take you by the hand and lead you on the path of what we think your recovery should be, then we're doing a disservice to you. So we tell people you need to be assertive and you need to be your own best self-advocate. So that's why, you know, honestly, having our customers witness just what advocating for your rights and for yourself actually has the power to potentially do. That's exactly what this is all about.
I notice you use the terms like customers and clients today instead of, some people in the mental health field would say, patients. So talk to me a little bit about the language difference there.
We are a peer-run agency, which means that I think the statistic is somewhere around 80-some-odd% of us that work for Restoration Society self-identify as peers. So we're not a we may be clinicians, we're obviously service providers, but we come with lived experience. We come with shared experience, and as a peer, we strive to be really transparent about that part of ourselves, right? It's one thing to, you know, say what we think is best practice, but it's another thing to say I've lived it and this is what was best practice for me and potentially maybe for you.
And talk a little bit more about Restoration Society for people who aren't familiar.
Restoration Society, we just celebrated 50 years. We are one of the last of a dying breed of true grassroots, not-for-profit, consumer or customer-driven passion work. We are all about providing a framework for what our customers' mental health recovery journey is going to look like. So we cover the basics from housing to safe space to access to a recovery center and all those services, employment services, core services, which are designed to meet someone on a more individual basis. We provide a program, multiple programs within one agency that's kind of like one-stop shopping, you know? And the beauty of it is we acknowledge and we're very transparent with our customer from day one that we can't do everything. And don't expect us to do everything. But if we can't do it, we're gonna find out and figure out who can.
I noticed as I've been covering the budget as it relates to mental health, a lot of the focus does get put on clinical services, crisis services. Talk to me about why that holistic approach that your organization takes works, or why it's important, sure, or how it fits in.
Well, you know, in psychiatric rehabilitation language, you know, there is a benefit, obviously, to the clinical side of mental health services. But a lot of folks who are just maybe at their rock bottom, that are coming off of maybe recently being unhoused or homeless, they're very pre-contemplative. They're not ready to talk about what treatment looks like in the capacity of possible clinical services. They want to know that they can go somewhere where they're going to be around peers, where they're going to have the safest space that we can possibly provide, where they know they can get off the street, have a hot meal, find a sense of community, and then slowly build on all of those things to develop a framework, to develop a set of goals that can and possibly potentially lead up to clinical services in that side of recovery. But we offer a more sort of holistic, very, you know, warm, inviting, fostering sort of approach.
And I understand if you can't answer my next question, but I'm kind of wondering your personal opinion, not the opinion of your agency. I know you're not speaking on behalf of your agency, but a lot of what was talked about today is the difference between voluntary and involuntary commitment and treatment. And I know the governor is pushing for expansion of involuntary treatment. Is there a role for involuntary treatment in the mental health system? Like, what, on a personal level, do you see it fitting in?
I think there's very specific, extreme, and individualized cases where, sure, I think for that person's safety, yeah, maybe sometimes involuntary treatment does need to be an option. But what we've learned, what I've learned, and what I've learned through Restoration Society is that a lot of times if you just take the time to get to know the person, meet them where they're at, and allow them to feel and know that they're in a safe environment, which can lead to conversation, which can lead to goal exploration, you'll see that there's other options, that there's other viable options and avenues that they can take.
A question I've been asking a lot of people today is, you know, I've heard from people who are strong advocates for involuntary commitment, involuntary treatment, Kendra's Law. Some of them will say, well, people with mental health conditions, they're not well enough to make those decisions for themselves. And I've heard a very different narrative from mental health advocates who work with people with mental health conditions or live with mental health conditions themselves. I'm wondering, like, if you were face to face with a legislator who was telling you that this is needed because someone can't make that decision for themselves, what would you say to them?
I would say to them that our community, our mental health community, is much more diverse than I ever would have imagined before I entered the field. We have, in that diversity, people who are beyond educated, beyond wise, come with more life experience than I have at this point in my life, or may ever. And depending on where you are in your mental health recovery, I've learned that it's never an excuse for bad behavior. It's never an excuse for not wanting to at least make an attempt to put your best foot forward, to be your own best self-advocate when it comes to your recovery. You know, mental health struggles, recovery, that whole journey does not mean that you're stupid, does not mean that you're incapable, does not mean that you're able and willing, level-headed, intelligent.
How has working with the mental health community changed your own perspective about your mental health or how you care for yourself?
Well, you know, I think quite often when folks struggle with mental health, as I have, as someone who's peer certified and identifies as a peer, you often feel like you're on an island, like you're alone. And in my case, that aloneness could have been very dangerous.
And peer work can also be a motivator for people seeking recovery. Brandon White was eager to tell everyone throughout the day about Community Acts of Kindness, a program he helps run at Restoration Society. On the bus, he shared his story and how motivation has played a role in his recovery.
Why connect peers and people in recovery to this kind of volunteer work? Why is it so important?
Oh, yes, it's important. I would say it's important because in my personal experience, I think it's important because it demonstrates the value in helping someone else as far as it's the emotional benefit. It's the emotional benefit that from being kind. Just that's why we call it a community act of kindness. I think that being kind contributes toward motivation. Contributes toward a good feeling and contributes to healing. So, and for all, you know, everybody that experienced trauma in life, I think that kindness is a technique that can be used to bridge an emotional gap, letting someone know that you do care, and demonstrates a lot. Dealing with yourself first, then you can then it's applied to others. If that made any sense.
No, it did. And I mean, even today I noticed when we got to Albany, you were like the first person to be encouraging everyone and like bringing this sense of like kindness and joy to the day. And I see how it makes a difference in like the attitude of everyone.
No, you've been blessed.
I guess I'm wondering, like, was there an act of kindness that made a difference in your life that kind of inspires what you do?
Yes. Yes, indeed. To be truly honest, it's really working with and in the mental health community, displaced community. I'm sorry for my vocabulary, it's kind of different. They say homeless, I say displaced. Working and volunteering in there, and I've kind of seen the giving that happens in there when they have nothing, kind of resonated with me in my life. When I have nothing, but I'm still giving. And I think that is very inspiring. So this is what I do to give back. This is my life. It's like a standard that I live by.
Do you mind me asking if you're comfortable sharing a little bit more about your personal story?
My personal story, where do you want to start? I said there's many books. Well, I have a book, Trauma. Okay, I'm going to go to Trauma. I am a survivor, a brain injury survivor, attempted murder survivor. I've been shot down on the streets. I've been beat up, left for dead. I experienced police brutality. I experienced a lot of BS. Some for being ignorant and some for just being evil, if there's such thing as evil. My trauma comes from, I would just say being ignorant. So what you want me to share?
No, I was just, you know, you mentioned that it sounds like you went through a difficult time in your life that brought you to Restoration Society.
I ended up, I was homeless. I'm here in Buffalo, and some big wigs came and brought property, and of course I couldn't meet their standards, and of course I had to hit the streets. And I went to a shelter, and like I said, one of the bums or one of the homeless or one of the displaced said, "Hey, man, dude, if you want to go to a cool place, go check out down the street." So I went there. Those guys had a pool table. They had everything that I liked, but it was a positive trend. They had pool tables, bars, everything, but it wasn't no alcohol. It was just fun, and it was a recovery center. So I went there to just use them for their pool table and their bar, candy, and snacks, but their staff there was being, they was contributing towards, they introduced me to the world of recovery. You know, I didn't want to recover. You know, I didn't want to, I was just homeless. I just needed to probably tap in and get out of homelessness, but their staff just said, "Hey, Brandon, you have skills. I see a lot about you," and they was just bearing me towards different things. And the moment I became an advocate, they directed me to the Academy of Peer Services, and that's how I learned about the peer movement.
There's only a few weeks left for the governor and legislature to decide what they're ready to do. This has been What's Next on WBFO. A special thanks to the Alliance for Rights and Recovery and the group of advocates from Buffalo who allowed us to spend the day with them and hear their stories. You can listen to this episode and others on demand at WBFO.org. I'm Emily Watkins for WBFO.
Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.